America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. We're talking about boys now, as the song goes. On previous podcasts, we've had experts talking about the troubles that school-age boys are having in our society. Poor grades, addiction to video games, social limitations, growing numbers with conditions like ADHD, fewer going on to college. It begs the question, are girls soaring or are boys falling? We have an investigative journalist with us today who can actually add to the story of boys in our society and the obstacles they face. What she reports adds a disturbing new element to what you may have read or heard. That's all today on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Emma Brown. And she's written really just a wonderful book called To Raise a Boy, Classrooms, Locker Rooms, Bedrooms, and the Hidden Struggles of American Boyhood. And I know that this is not a topic that has been widely delved into, though I will say I have done some other reporting on this, Emma, from some other authors. But I think you've added to the lexicon because you've also added to the conversation the notion of sexual violence in relation to boys and how they treat each other in this culture, if you will.
Yeah, that's, you know, I started the book, the first chapter in the book is about the sexual victimization of boys, which, why would I start this book about boyhood in America with that? I mean, because it was the most profoundly of upsetting and also transformative reporting for me that I did in the course of working on this book. You know, I talked to hundreds of people, teachers and coaches and boys and their parents and researchers. But this notion that boys are experiencing sexual assault and even rape at higher rates than I think is apparent in our like national conversation about the problem of sexual violence really struck me because it forced me to confront and really deal with the fact that I had my own, you know, as enlightened as I may think I was, I had my own assumptions and stereotypes about boys. And realizing the extent of the problem of sexual violence against boys really, you know, brought that to the fore for me.
Not only that, but as you go along, you describe the fact that since boys often are victimized, even if they think it's horseplay by other boys, having to prove their own manhood in our culture. And I'm not going to call it toxic masculinity, because I know that is not a term that you like. But that leads to them then practicing this upon girls.
Well, I think what we know is that when boys are victims of violence, physical violence and sexual violence, and particularly when it's not dealt, you know, where they're not given the support that they need to heal from that, that there are long-lasting effects. And so when, you know, I wrote in the book about a boy, for example, who was sexually assaulted, he was in middle school, showed up to his brand new middle school, sixth grade in Oklahoma, and was sexually assaulted by fellow football players in front of his entire music class when the teacher was out of the room. When he went to go tell his principal, the principal later said to investigators, because this turned into a criminal investigation as well as a civil lawsuit, you know, had the same thing happened to a girl, I would have seen that as sexual assault. But since it was boys, I thought it was horseplay. And why does that matter? Because of the support that boys do or don't get, and because of whether we recognize their pain and help them deal with it. And so, yeah, I think, you know, if we don't give boys the tools to heal when they've been the victims of violence, it does make, the research shows that it can put boys doesn't condemn them to become abusers, of course, but it can put boys at greater risk of doing harm to girls and women in their lives.
You were quoted as saying, "I thought I knew that boys are victims only rarely, and I automatically equated child sexual abuse with adults preying on kids, but that you were wrong on both counts." What surprised you more, one or the other?
I think both are important. I mean, we hear sexual victimization of boys. I think a lot of us, our minds leap to the Catholic Church or Boy Scouts of America, older men preying on younger boys, and this data is suggesting that boys are also assaulted at high rates by their peers, both boys and girls. I think it's really important for sort of seeing the whole picture of what's happening with boys. We talk sometimes about rape myths, like girls, were asking for it if they're wearing a short skirt, those kinds of rape myths. But we don't always talk about the rape myths that exist around boys and men and the misconceptions we may have about their experiences in unwanted sexual encounters.
How prevalent do you think it is, boy on boy? Is it confined to sports activities? Is it these all-male schools that you do report on in the book? Or is it widely more prevalent than that?
Well, right. In the book, I write about a couple of situations which are sort of sexual assaults or rapes in the context of sports, sometimes called hazing. And there is no, unfortunately, good data on how prevalent that is. And one reason is because it's really hard to ask young people in general, minors, about anything related to sex or sexual assault because of sensitivities around their age. So researchers really just don't have a good grasp on the numbers, although people who pay attention to this believe that it's becoming more common. But I think other kinds of sexual assault where, you know, I think a really important one to point out is boys are taught that they are always supposed to want sex. So when boys get that message and then they have an encounter with a girl or another boy, sexual encounter that doesn't feel good to them, that they didn't want, they have really conflicting messages about, I'm supposed to want this, I don't want this, what do I call this, how do I say no? And that, I think a really important message to give boys early on is that their bodies, you know, same message we give our girls, your body is sacred. You get to decide who touches you and who doesn't. And by the way, boys don't always want sex. It's okay to not want to have a sexual encounter so that they can really decide when they are making decisions about their intimate relationships. They have the opportunity to say no and to feel like that's a really healthy and good choice for them if that's what feels right.
Yet they are maligned, as you point out in the book, for that decision, called names by other boys, and really challenged to prove their quote-unquote manhood.
Yeah, and I think there's one pretty startling study on boys who have sexual intercourse before the age of 13, which of course is far earlier than they are able to consent under state laws around our country. Rates vary dramatically depending on what city you're in, and also they vary according to race. So black boys are more likely to have these early sexual encounters. And I think, you know, in talking to researchers, they'll say that's because, or at least one reason, is because but black boys get this message even stronger about the sort of sexualization of their bodies, and they are seen as sort of, you know, they've been cast in many boys, black boys and men as sexual predators. And so we don't see perhaps that when they are young, they're very young, having sexual encounters, that is a form of sexual assault that we need to be aware of, and helping boys to understand that this pressure that they feel to be men, to want sex, even when they're younger than 13, is really destructive for them.
In some of the other reporting we've done on this podcast about boys and boys in crisis, one book, Boy Crisis, by Warren Farrell and John Gray, who is known for his book about men and women, and then another by Dr. Leonard Sachs. And Dr. Sachs said that the testosterone levels of young boys are going down, and in fact that in many cases, boys really are living more in a virtual world. much more interested, really, in an online world than a tactile world where emotions have to be expressed. Can you put that together in any understandable way for us?
I'm not familiar with that part of Dr. Sachs's research, but I think that all of our kids right now have been forced into this really virtual world through the pandemic, mm-hmm. and that we're going to be grappling with the impacts of that. We are grappling with it now, and we'll continue to see, you know, we have to see what sort of what the long-lasting effects are going to be in terms of our children's and our own habits, you know, as we move through the world. So I think that that question about how we live our lives online versus tactile is going to be, is even more pressing now. And I think I used to teach middle school math, and in my experience with children in that age group, I just think, you know, the more we can give them experiences to learn in a hands-on way and to interact in a face-to-face way, especially after this long hiatus of that kind of interaction, is important.
Do you get the sense from all of your reporting, all the people that you've talked to, that it corroborates what some of these other experts are saying, that boys in our culture are in trouble, that they're not performing well in school? In many cases, when we look at women who are getting married later in life, I remember one other guest telling me that's because they can't find a suitable partner. Lots of guys failing to launch. What do you think's going on?
One of the things that really struck me in my research was really sprawling research project led by scholars at Johns Hopkins University. They are studying gender among 10 to 14-year-olds all over the world. And what they found was that there's really a common global script, they said, for sort of messages that girls get about how they're and who they're supposed to be, and the messages that boys get about how and who they're supposed to be. And while the sort of rigid ideas have really started to loosen more for girls, so that girls have more access to things that in the past have been thought of as masculine, that has not happened for boys, and that boys are still sort of told that there is, on the one hand, that there's, you know, one way for them to be. So they're being told that, and yet they're living in a world that's really also giving them a message that they need to be different, at least I think in this country. So I think that, I think many of the boys I spoke to who are important experts in my view, said it can be a pretty confusing time right now. Also confusing, I mean, this book came out of the fact that my son was born right as the Me Too movement erupted, and it made me think about how am I going to raise my son. One of the ways in which we don't give our sons much guidance, I think, and is a big problem, is around intimate relationships and sexuality. And, you know, they are very aware that they are growing up in a time when there's accountability for sexual misbehavior, and they feel that pressure. And yet sex education has, and this startled me as a former education reporter, evaporated out of many public schools. Parents, surveys show, don't talk to their sons about, in many cases, they're not talking to their sons about what it means to have a healthy and respectful romantic relationship. And so there's this sort of absence or void of guidance, and then a real prevalence of online pornography that carries all kinds of messages about what sex is supposed to look like, supposed to be like, and a lot of times shows images that are not consensual or respectful. And so I think we put our sons in a bind when we fail to give them guidance, particularly on this front, and then they understand the pressure that they face to do right. I mean, yes, to do right, but we're not really showing them the roadmap for that.
To raise a boy, Emma Brown is our guest on America Trends. And you started off the book saying, for me, raising a boy feels a little like traveling in a foreign land. And then you went on to say, it's easy to have a pithy motto for your daughter in these times, I am strong and fearless. And of course, boys have always gotten the message, be strong, be a guy, man up, don't show your feelings, your emotions, don't show tears. And that's obviously repressing a lot of what really goes on in a young child's life.
Family therapist Terry Real describes it as teaching boys that they must have themselves, as in cut in half, cut cut off the parts or bury the parts of oneself that are seen as feminine, including, I mean, it's not just sparkles and pink, but really important human connection and connection and the ability to recognize, articulate emotion. And so, you know, I talked to boys who definitely got that message from their parents and from other people and the culture around them. One boy talked to me about being told as a young boy, you know, not only you're not to cry because you're a boy, but also you're not to dance. He loved to dance, and it was his expression of joy. And when he was 6 years old, his father told him he should not do that, that it looked gay. And so I think, you know, that the messages that boys get around burying their true selves can be really damaging. You may have interviewed some of the experts on your podcast who write about and research men's health. And I think the outcomes that we see in men's health speak to the need to help boys learn how to ask for help, learn how to and feel comfortable doing so. I mean, men die by suicide nearly four times the rate as women. And that is an astonishing fact that is not a new fact, but really, I think, speaks to the need for us to do better by young boys in their emotional lives.
Well, I think your book points out that we really don't understand boys because of the pain that is obviously being demonstrated. One in six boys, through a known survey, you suggest have been assaulted or abused. Then we see the suicide rates that you just mentioned spiking. And you do point to one thing that I think is really interesting in that context. And I think any man will admit to this if they're really pressed. And that is that they lose close association and contact with other men in ways that women generally don't. How important is that going through a long life, needing friends? I know I've been trying to reconnect with a lot of people during this pandemic, and it really makes me feel so good. Sometimes, no matter what else I'm doing during a day, having reached out and talked to two or three other guys is the best thing I do for myself.
So true. And I think, you know, there's a wealth of research and growing body every day about loneliness and about its impact on our physical health and our mental health. And so I think, you know, one of the most poignant moments I had in reporting this book was talking with a man who was 50 when I met him. I met him at a men's group, where he told me he had started coming because he woke up, and realized in middle age, he felt alone. He said, you know, he had people to hang out with, but he didn't have people to share deeply with his life. And so he had started coming to this group to try to form that kind of relationship with other men. And I think, you know, the research of Niobe Way, who is a New York University professor and has studied, cohorts of teenagers. So she, you know, chooses a group of boys and then interviews them over the course of years to learn about their friendships and how their friendships change. And what she has found through that work is they need and crave emotionally intimate friendships just as girls do, and that they really have those friendships when they're children and in early adolescence. And then there reaches a point in mid-adolescence where boys tend to lose those kinds of very close friendships and can't regain them or rebuild them. And that, she says, is right around the time when the suicide rate among boys really skyrockets over and above that of girls of the same age. So that's, of course, correlation and not causation, but I do think that making way for boys to sort of acknowledge and value that they really want to need close friendships is important, and something that I, as a mom, am definitely thinking. My son's three, but I'm thinking about how we, his father and I, model that for him and help him see the great value in those kinds of close relationships.
What about role modeling in all of this? Obviously, men are absent more often than not than women in a parenting situation. What does that do in terms of the importance? I know there was another guest of ours saying that in the African American community, oftentimes the young boys really don't have the right role models left in the community to really give them a sense of possibility and hope.
I think it is important for boys to have role models, strong role models who are women and strong role models who are men. And if they, if there's not a role model in their own home, then there are incredible opportunities for communities, for schools, for faith organizations to help give boys strong male role models outside their home. So I visited a really successful program in Chicago that was established actually by a man who said he had grown up without his father and wanted to make sure that boys had strong role models somewhere if they didn't have them in his home. And so this program, which is called Becoming a Man in Chicago, gives boys a really strong mentor in the form of a counselor and a strong peer relationship. So they boys gather together once a week and they sit in a circle and they share on a really deep level. I mean, boys told me they were sort of shocked when they came in from the regular part of school where they saw each other walking down the hallway looking tough and then sat together and really shared what was going on in their lives. But this program, I mean, as an education reporter who has looked at a lot of research studies on the effects of various interventions and programs, this one really stands out. Boys who go through it are 50% less likely to be arrested for violent crimes, and they're 19% more likely to graduate from high school. And, you know, there's been actually lots of academic sort of study about, well, why does this program work so well? And there's some back and forth about that. But if you ask the boys, why does this program work so well? They say, because of the relationships that we have with each other and the relationship that I have with my counselor. I feel like I want to do right for this group because, you know, I feel accountable to them. I feel loved by them. And it speaks to the incredible power of positive relationships to protect boys, I think, which is something that's been shown in all kinds of longitudinal research studies that have shown the power of a relationship with a caring adult as protection against all kinds of things that we want to protect boys against, you know, from substance abuse to depression and other ills.
As we are trying to empower young girls to think about the limitless possibilities in the STEM field, and as you said, you were a math teacher, so you understand that clearly. And then, of course, we've got people who are gay and who might be bisexual or people who may be transsexual, and they're claiming their identity today in our society and wanting to be recognized. What is that doing to the overall climate as boys try to find themselves?
I think that we live in a really polarized country, and so discussions about LGBT people and LGBT rights and LGBT identities vary really dramatically for boys depending on where they grow up. And so that some boys feel they're growing up in communities, they tell me, where they feel like they can be themselves no matter what, whether that means coming out as gay or coming out as transgender. Other boys, I think, are growing up in families or in communities where they still feel a lot of shame about whether we're talking about gender identity or sexual orientation, feel a lot of shame about not sort of conforming to what has traditionally been seen as what it means to be a boy. And so I think the experiences of boys around those issues just vary really dramatically.
You do talk in the book about boys and affirmative consent, and I'd like to spend just a moment on this because I think it's an important topic. It was Donald Trump who said it's a very scary time for young men in America, and that was during the point of the Brett Kavanaugh situation. You reported on that extensively. So he's trying to say, well, you know, how does a boy know how to control their impulses at this stage or that, and this whole notion of affirmative consent? Can you help us through that?
We have been talking more to boys and girls about consent, but in my traveling to schools and various communities around the country, I heard consent framed often as no means no or yes means yes. So either of those sort of pithy ways of talking about consent, I think, are really way too oversimplified and end up being confusing to boys and to girls when they're in in real life encounters. So, for example, one young man I met at Wabash College, which is an all-male, 4-year all-male college, one of the few remaining in this country, said in a course, I'm sitting in on his course, and he said, you know, we are taught no means no, so that means we need to get her to say yes, like convince her to say yes. And I thought, oh my gosh, that pretty much succinctly states the problem with how we talk about consent, that our goal is not to sort of, our goal should not be, or my goal with my son is not to sort of, for him to learn what is the very minimum thing I must do so that I don't get in trouble, but to think about how do I listen? How do I listen deeply to what this person is telling me about what they want, whether they're telling me with words or they're telling me with body language? And then how do I respect that rather than how do I get what I want? So I think those are just very different ways of talking about consent. And I borrow a term from two Columbia University professors who have studied sexual violence on their campus, sexual citizenship, which is the idea that we all have dignity and we all deserve to have self-determination over what happens to our bodies. That means, you know, we ourselves, each of us gets to decide, and we also owe our partners in intimate relationships that respect. And so I think the danger in how we talk about consent is in this sort of oversimplified way that ignores power dynamics in relationships. It ignores body language. There is research showing that boys, for example, they are actually listening for a no to, as the signpost for like, this has gone too far and I must stop. Whereas girls in the same study are saying, well, sometimes silence means I'm consenting. Sometimes silence means I'm really uncomfortable and I just don't know how to say it. And so, you know, we just have to be really clear that communication happens in a lot of ways besides somebody screaming at no and running out of a room.
There was a series recently on Hulu called Teacher, and I thought they did a really good job, Emma, of showing the sex that injured the boy. And it was a female teacher, and you might have thought that they were in love or that they thought they were or what have you. But then they really broke that down to show that this boy was being abused. And I think many times in our culture, we have a hard time thinking of that as abuse. You also say that there are other myths about boys that we still believe. Which are the ones that we're really hanging on to that we really need to discard?
Well, I think that this idea that you alluded to and that we talked about a bit before, when, you know, about the sexual victimization of boys, it's just an idea that boys don't feel pain as deeply as girls is, I think, one that underlies a lot of assumptions about boys. And I wrote in the book about a study that is pretty well known called the Still Face Study. So this is where mothers and babies, or parents and babies, are in a lab together. And at first, they're normally interacting. And, you know, if you've been around a baby, you know that when you look at a baby and they start cooing at you and you can't help because it's human instinct, right, to just to react and to smile. And that's like, that's the normal interaction. So the researcher then tells the parent to go stone-faced, to stop reacting, to not smile, you know, nothing with your eyes. And you can look at videos of this online, and it's quite hard to watch because the babies become very distressed. They get really upset when the parent is no longer connecting with them. And that's equally true of boy babies and girl babies. I talked to Dr. Edward Tronick, who initially designed this study, as well as other folks who have thought deeply about it. And while they you know, different scholars have different interpretations, but I think they agree that what this shows is that babies, regardless of gender, have a really innate desire to connect and to be connected with one another. And that babies, regardless of gender, feel the pain of that disconnection really deeply. And so, you know, I sort of carry that with me as a reminder when I'm thinking, for example, about my own son, about the equality that exists among boys and girls when it comes to our need for connection and our pain when we don't have it.
As a mother, not as a great investigative reporter, put on that hat now, you do say in the book that biological differences have real consequence between boys and girls. Some things are not affected as much by socialization. What is it that you do? I mean, I know the old stereotype of G.I. Joe versus Barbie, but how are you doing 3 years in to understanding what's going on in the foreign land of your son?
I was interested to learn that I wrote in the book about the flood of testosterone in the uterus when you're having, you know, when a mother is having a boy, that researchers believe has something to do with, for example, shaping play preferences. But I also wrote about how, though there are in many cases small average differences between boys and girls, you know, the variation within boys and within girls is huge and overlapping. So that when your kid is born, you know, whatever set of genitals they have, you don't know who they're going to become. And I think, you know, one thing I've learned from this book is I want to be open to whoever my son is going to be, whoever my daughter is going to be, whatever their aptitudes and passions are going to be. And so one researcher described our brains when we're born, you know, when it comes to all kinds of aptitudes, sort of like language, you know, our brains are born. We can speak any language when we're born if we are exposed to it. So our kids have so much potential when they're born if they're exposed to all different kinds of learning and all different kinds of opportunities. So I think about it with my son is I want to give him access to all different kinds of things to play with and learn about and be excited about and passionate about. And then he will have that opportunity to learn and to not be shamed into thinking he only has one set of choices in his life. I guess that's the other important thing that I don't want him to feel ashamed of what he naturally loves or is passionate about, whatever that is.
However, you say as a former teacher that we've got to go back into the school setting to see that standardized tests that measure a lot of things about cognition often miss emotional learning that's been submerged. And you also point out about sex education, that so much has been diminished in our curricula. How important is it to get some of that back? And do you see that as a trend anywhere? Of course, we deal with trends. I mean, in this time of flux as it relates to gender identity, do you see that being important? And do you see us making some of the right moves back into learning about ourselves in different ways, the seven intelligences, if you will?
I think that, the Me Too movement spurred a kind of a spate of legislation to teach more about consent in schools and to do more sex education. However, I also think that this pandemic has really created a lot of questions about what school is going to be and look like when kids go back in a more normal way. I think schools are really stretched and that they are going to be called upon to acknowledge and support children in their emotional realms, social and emotional realms. So I think, you know, I wrote in the book, as you say, about social emotional learning and how powerful that can be when it's done well. And I got to watch two really expert teachers, fourth grade teachers, as they gave their kids a real gift of being able to talk with one another and acknowledge to themselves their struggles around sort of interpersonal and intrapersonal stuff that we all deal with as humans. So I think that there will be a sort of a new pressure probably for schools to do more of that because it's just unavoidable what will someday be hopefully a post-pandemic world because kids have experienced so much hard stuff during this time. But when it comes to sex education, I don't know. I think that may continue to be something that is easier for schools to not do. I know, you know, having worked as a reporter around schools for a long time, having worked in schools, that it can, you know, for schools to take on sex education in a really comprehensive way can feel risky to educators because there can be parents and others in community who don't feel that that's the appropriate role for the school. So, I think when schools are already stretched that may be, in some cases more than they are ready or able to take on.
Given your reporting, Do you think that boys are getting the requisite and the right attention for what it is that they too are struggling with, or should at least be exposed to, so that they are that whole and not half individual? Do you think we're doing that yet, or are we just letting that slide while we correct for things that we did not do to encourage girls to pursue their maximum capability?
I think there is more and more attention to helping boys understand the messages that are beamed at them about what it means to be a boy, helping them think through those messages and sort of be skeptical consumers of those messages. So I actually finished this book feeling a lot of hope and feeling like my son is growing up in a really good time to be growing up as a boy. I think it's fair to say, proliferation of efforts around the country to do this, to pay attention to the particular efforts of boys. I mean, as I said, I was in Chicago. I went to Maine, which is obviously a very different part of our country, suburban San Francisco, here in Washington, D.C. So I saw efforts all over the place. And I also felt like there were so many boys who were leading this effort and leading this conversation to help give boys the support they need to have strong relationships in particular. And there is one boy who comes to mind, and this is at a all-boys middle school in Berkeley, California, who said, you know, he was 12, I think, when I met him, and he said, you know, that saying, boys will be boys. Well, what that means is boys can be anyone they want. Boys can be compassionate. Boys can be creative. We don't have to be held back by stereotypes. And I thought that that was a pretty, like, when I think about my son, who is, you know, as a three-year-old, kind of just beginning to show who more of who he's going to be, it's very exciting to think that he could grow up in an environment where he's told he can be anything he wants to be.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Emma Brown, for the continuing contribution that people like you are making to this issue of a crisis for boys. And you've added to the dimension of the problem in your book, To Raise a Boy, Classrooms, Locker Rooms, Bedrooms, and the Hidden Struggles of American Boyhood. Thanks so much for being with us today on America Trends.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.